Rebag, your premier destination for luxury resale. Elevate your style with our curated collection of bags, watches, and fine jewelry. At Rebag, quality is our priority. Each piece meticulously vetted and verified by experts, ensuring your investment is nothing short of perfection. Buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Hermes, Chanel, and Cartier. Access expertly crafted and hard-to-find pieces that redefine luxury. Your next investment awaits at Rebag. Get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. That's 10% off the luxury you deserve. Don't miss out. Head to Rebag.com and enter code REBAG10 at checkout. That's REBAG10.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to the Prospect Podcast. I'm Tom Clark, and this week we're going to be talking to the former Daily Telegraph editor Charles Moore about Margaret Thatcher, whose heavyweight three-part biography has just been completed. First, though, I'm joined by Prospect's own Alex Dean, who, it has to be said, was born a few years after Margaret Thatcher was shunted out of Downing Street. So, Alex, whereas my own childhood into my early teens were dominated, like, in terms of the news and everything, by Margaret Thatcher, to you, she's just a figure of history, I guess.
Yes, she's totally in the past. I mean, obviously her shadow looms large over the party, the Conservative Party and the country. I think my figure who I had an equivalent sort of relationship with was Tony Blair, that you maybe had with Thatcher, and that he was kind of the monster, a caricature almost of something to be scared of. And that was the figure that I grew up with, everyone hating around me.
But were you aware of, with Thatcher, like, her as a big presence as a girl, you know, when you were 10 or 11 or 12, would you have known much about her, or would she just have been as irrelevant as Stanley Baldwin or something?
I think she was definitely more relevant than that. And very quickly, just even, you know, before I was anything like as political as I am now, you get the sense that she still has so many disciples. So she's relevant in that sense. And then, of course, like, kind of get older and older, and now as a political journalist, she's incredibly relevant because she's got these heirs in the party, you know, the neo-Thatcherites who want to kind of deregulate Britain. They think that Europe's holding us back, and, you know, the Rees-Moggs and so on.
Not many of the younger generation of Conservatives would openly disavow her. I mean, even David Cameron, who wanted to modernise and move beyond Thatcherism and all that, he was careful about it because he knew he had to be. But you've been talking to some of the old guard, haven't you, who have got slightly less doubts than youngsters about dissing the Thatcher legacy.
Yeah, exactly. I spoke to Michael Heseltine fairly recently about the Tory party's record on Europe, and his view was basically that Britain achieved a huge amount on the continent in the 80s under Thatcher. The Conservative Party, he thinks, is kind of the party of Europe by rights. The expansion of the single market, eliminating trade barriers and so on, which was kind of Thatcher at her best in his view, and actually in mine. And it's a tragedy in his view that the party is now turning against its own achievements. And we had a really good piece on the website recently by David Anderson, the lawyer, who worked in the private office of Lord Cockfield, who was part of all this.
European Act, all that.
Yeah, exactly that. And he basically was making exactly the same point. And, he's a fair bit younger than Heather, but the overarching principle that it's Thatcher's legacy on Europe is actually could be something for Remainers to celebrate, at least if you take it in chunks and you look at the right bit.
If you stop in 1987 sharp, which actually is where Charles Moore's new book begins, so I'll be fairly careful to make sure I talk to him about that that pivot. What are your thoughts about her as a wider cultural figure? Obviously, she's got some significance symbolically simply by being the first woman prime minister. She turned the terms of the debate, not just on Europe, but on things like markets, what the government should be doing and shouldn't be doing. Although some people since are saying that we had a big pivot with Margaret Thatcher and just now we're still pivoting back away from her. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think the main thing I think about Thatcher now when I think about politics is, I mean, everyone always asks that question of whether Brexit would have happened without austerity. And it was a knife-edge vote and you think, well, realistically, probably not. Mm. I mean, whatever you think about austerity, probably not, just, you know, put on the probabilities. And I wonder the same question about Thatcher. If, you know, would Brexit have happened if we hadn't have had the plans that she implemented in the 80s in the north and so on? I don't know. In fact, actually, I think it probably wouldn't have happened.
So she continues then, in your view, as a youngster, to haunt the political scene. Well, let's go over now and meet Charles Moore, who is the man who has dedicated 20 years of his life now to chronicling Margaret Thatcher's life.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Welcome, Charles. Now, all the reviews, including one upcoming in Prospect, are agreed that in terms of primary research and writing this new volume, based as it is on literally hundreds of interviews and thousands of documents, is, like your trilogy as a whole, a titanic achievement. So congratulations. But as well as the book, we need to talk about the woman herself. The volume covers the years in which she was at her most uncompromising and also the years in which income inequality shot out of control. And I'm interested in your sense of whether or not she cared a jot about that.
Mrs. Thatcher didn't believe in economic equality because of what she believed about socialism, which was that in its attempt to equalise, it found it much easier to lower than to raise, and that it identified successful things and attacked them rather than failing things and giving them more opportunity. So she believed that that opportunity and freedom were the key issues in economics, and that these will tend to the general good. Obviously, they didn't work to the general good in every case. So that would be her. In her mind, the justification for her position. There was a famous speech she made when she was still leader of the opposition in New York, I think, when she said, let our children grow tall, and some taller than others if they have the capacity, or something like that.
Yeah, so she's an out-and-out inegalitarian, if you like. And obviously that gives rise to very different reactions in different places. Whilst you were, I think, a political columnist at The Telegraph, I was a child growing up in Yorkshire, where, you know, she was almost literally a monster. At my grandmother's 60th, I remember some grown-ups telling me she was in the next room. That's when I was seven. When I was eight, a week after the Brighton bomb, and I remember my mother thinking this was appalling, my socialist mother, but one of the neighbours had got Margaret Thatcher as a guy on the fire. You know, it's tasteless, but it gives you a sense of how raw the emotions were in much of the country.
It does. I think that though they certainly did strongly exist, they are exaggerated. If they were as great as people say, she would never have won general elections. And they, those emotions were not, didn't run over, let's say, everybody who considered themselves working class in the north, for example. I mean, take the phenomenon of working miners. You know, one reason Scargill's strike failed is because roughly a third of the miners refused to go on strike. Very, very important. And Mrs. Thatcher was very close to them and had secret meetings with them and so on. So it's a more, it's not such a black and white picture as perhaps you're suggesting. But I think she certainly was very polarizing. And to some extent, though obviously nobody likes being hated, she intended it in the sense that one of her aims in politics was to get people to make up their mind. Mm. What she saw as the problem of the 1970s was that people knew there were big problems, but they couldn't quite confront them. So actually it was a cross-party view, for example, that trade union leaders had too much power, but nobody would quite sort of tackle it. And so she sort of, she said, come on, are you with me or against me? Are we going to do this or not?
Yes, I've heard her quote some poem where it's, if you're not making any enemies, you're not making, you're not doing any good.
You have no enemies, my friend. You have no enemies, you say, my friend, your boast is poor. It's a poem by a Scottish socialist, actually, about, you know, you have to make enemies in order to achieve your results, because you are confronting things that are difficult to confront and people who won't like it.
Now, while you open our eyes to her capacity to engage, don't know if you like the word, but intellectually, in progressive ways, especially, say, on climate change, I'm still interested to know if, counter to the monster I was brought up, you think she could engage empathetically. You've got Brian Griffiths, who's one of her senior aides, saying she wasn't heartless, she'd told him, she was Victorian. But isn't a Victorian definition of heartlessness, you know, almost a definition that carries on as if Charles Dickens had never been written?
Because Charles Dickens himself was Victorian.
Well, the spirit of improvement
and social reform were very, very strong in the Victorian era. And that's what she was trying to talk about. I mean, I see why people ask this question, but the classic answer to it lies in her famous interview with Woman's Own, where she said there's no such thing as society.
Yes.
And those who wished to see it this way thought that she was asserting naked individualism. She really wasn't. And if you read the whole of the interview, and I discuss this in the book, there's an
You've got a chapter on it.
Well, it was a part of a chapter, yes. It really is unsustainable to say that's what she's saying. What she's saying, if she were a modern person, she would say there's no such thing as society, and she would put quote marks in the air with her fingers. People didn't do that then, but she's asking, almost like a scientist trying to understand the composition of something, what is this thing we call society? And she says it's made up of individuals and families. And the reason she's saying that is not because it doesn't matter, but because it does. She's trying to bring it home to everybody that it's their responsibility to bring it together and make it work. So actually what she's advocating, I think, really, is a sort of Methodist idea, which was often very much influenced by socialism and also influenced socialism, but wasn't exactly socialist, of a Christian social order in Britain, sort of grew out of Protestantism. And that's what she's hoping for, in which people have their rights, and because they have their rights, they have to fulfil their responsibilities.
And yet you also describe, and you're very upfront about this in the book, that there's a paradox here, which is while she's pushing her conception of liberty, particularly in terms of letting people do what they want in the marketplace, the kind of good human beings that you might want to fulfil that Methodist order don't necessarily come forward. Instead, you've got people who might like gambling and pornography and easy divorces and God knows what else.
She embodied in herself an eternal tension that exists between, and often exists in the same person as it did with her, between a liberal approach to life and a conservative approach to life. And I think she would have said in answer to this, though I can't think of a particular quote, that, well, actually, there is a quote she used from Confucius, which she wrote in her commonplace book. You need people to be free, but you need them to benefit from the tradition and history and teaching of people who've come before. And therefore, institutions, national independence, religion and so on matter a great deal, as well as people's freedom. And the fact that you're free doesn't mean that all the choices you make as a free person are good. Obviously, it's part of the freedom is to be bad as well as to be good. And it's, you're right that it did distress her when she saw a sort of loads of money characters. Obviously, if there's more money around, there'll be more visible loads of money characters. But that distressed her, but it wouldn't lead her to believe that what she was doing was wrong.
Let's move on to international relations, which consumes quite a big chunk of the book and was the stage of her premiership where she was most dominant, I guess, on the world stage. It's a very mixed story, isn't it? Catastrophic mishandling by the sounds of things of Helmut Kohl, but like a very early, insightful and, dare I say, an empathetic kind of relationship with Gorbachev.
It's quite true. It wasn't too bad with Kohl early on, where they both agreed about the installation of cruise and Pershing missiles in the early 80s. But towards the end, she was very, very distressed with the European community's way of doing things. And she particularly disliked Kohl in this respect, because he was so keen on European unity and moving towards ever closer union. Also with Jacques Delors on that. But also she did dislike him because he embodied in her mind sort of Germanness, and she had a Second World War dislike of the Germans, which she could often suspend in particular cases. And indeed, she admired Germany's economic recovery, but she couldn't get out of her head a fundamental suspicion of Germany because of and the past. And not being a very tactful woman, she said to Helmut Kohl at the end of the... just when the whole end of the Cold War, when the reunification of Germany was coming up, she met him at one of these conferences and she said, twice in this century, we've had to come and rescue Europe from you, and now you're back again. So naturally, he wasn't very pleased with it. So you're right that it's a painful moment for her, the reunification of Germany in particular, because... in a way, it was absolutely what she'd been working so hard for and very successfully about the end of the Cold War.
Mm.
The peaceful transition to a democratic, pluralistic order and the defeat of communism. Absolutely perfect, what she'd always been calling for. But the price of the reunification of Germany, particularly when it was associated by the European community with greater European integration and the creation of a single currency, was very high for her. And she couldn't properly reconcile these two, and this isolated her at the very end from particularly Kohl and George Bush.
Yes, and of course it isolated her back home as well, didn't it? But
yes, of course, it was a contributory to her fall very much. Yeah,
I mean, we do want to focus mostly on Thatcher and her times rather than the Echo for now, but we can't resist bringing up Brexit now.
Sure.
We know that she was pro EEC as then was in 1975 and through to the creation of the single market. Now, the conventional story we tell is she liked it thus far as it was a free trading thing, and then it all got a bit too regulatory and protected and she sort of socialism by the back door. But I think what you're alluding to there is that there might be a different geopolitical way of reading her pivot against Europe, so that she liked it when it was, you know, an adjunct to NATO. It was part of standing up to the Soviet Union. But as soon as that was no longer necessary, she started to see it maybe as a backdoor for German domination of the continent again. Do you think that's right?
I think that is essentially right. So she took, actually, I'm not sure how aware she was, that she took a classic British foreign policy attitude to Europe, which is that you don't want one power dominating the continent of Europe.
Yeah.
And she also, you're absolutely right, saw the EC as a sort of useful adjunct to NATO in the early days. And she also feared that if you did have one power dominating the continent of Europe, it would become more anti-American, and that it would encourage the Americans, which she was always trying to discourage them from disengaging with Europe. She always wanted to keep Americans in the European continent militarily and to maintain a political interest in it. So, of course, it's distressing for her that Bush saw it in a different way. So that is the trajectory. But I also think there is the basic thing never left her, even when she was at her most pro-European, which is Britain should be an independent nation with a democratic system which you can elect your rulers and get rid of them. And she did not like that about the fact that you could do neither of those things with the European community. And that's where she got to by the end of her time, shortly before she fell. And at the Rome summit at the end of October 1990.
So this is a month or so before she goes.
Yes, exactly. She got very angry indeed because they insisted on pushing forward with the single currency, the Delors plan. And she came home in a rage. And I happened to meet her at a reception at number 10 that night. And she came sort of beetling up. She could be very, very unguarded, which is great if you're a journalist. And she said that we should put this to the British people. Do the British people want the people they elect to rule them, or do they want to be ruled by people they can't elect and can't get rid of? I thought, wow, that's interesting. Very clearly stated, and also not government policy. That struck me very much.
And it never became government policy, did it, under her?
Under her, no. Well, there was no time left, really, for her government. But she wasn't actually saying at that moment referendum, but she was really talking more about an election. But then, after Geoffrey Howe resigned and the challenge came and the contest came, she gave several press interviews, one of them to me, in which she explicitly said there should be a referendum on the single currency. So she put the referendum idea back in the system, which had been in abeyance since 1975. That's very significant politically and very distressing for Geoffrey, Michael Heseltine, and indeed people who were still ministers of the government, like Douglas Hurd and John Major. So she really put the cat among the pigeons, and I think all that contributed to her why her cabinet ministers were against, not why the population was more against her, but why the cabinet ministers were against her at the end of her time. The population in general and backbenchers were more concerned about the poll tax, but at the top was Europe. And therefore, she'd sown this seed, and therefore you can trace this genealogy to Brexit, because all through the 90s there was endless referendum talk.
Mm.
The referendum party, which Mrs. Thatcher favoured, though obviously she didn't vote for it. By the time of the 97 election campaign, I think all the parties were committed to a referendum just because they were frightened.
On the single currency.
Yes. And so the idea continued. It developed according to what, so there should be on
the Constitution.
Should be on the Constitution, Lisbon, so on. And finally we get to Cameron making the promise before the 2015 election and fulfilling it the year after.
And that, again, as well as the substantive question of Europe, is a swerve, isn't it? Because back in the 70s, I'm sure I've read quotes from her calling the referendum, you know, the tool of despots or whatever, which is how traditionally English people
thought of it. That's right. I think she quotes somebody else as saying that, but she quotes it with approval.
Mm.
But actually, there are examples. I'm sorry, I can't immediately call them to mind what the subjects were, when she did surprise people by proposing referendums on one or two other things. She always, it was a sort of escape route for her when she was trying to push an idea which most of her colleagues didn't want.
Mm.
I'm sorry, it's in the book, but I simply can't remember what it was, but there was at least one occasion when she said, well, maybe this is suitable for a referendum. And she was always conscious that her party, particularly at a senior level, would be reluctant about some of the things that she wanted to do, and she believed that she had a bigger reach towards the wider population on some issues than most of her colleagues.
And so
she would sort of invoke that.
So, I mean, clearly she was instrumental in both this idea of a referendum and in the kind of anti-European turn of the British discourse. Like, do you think she'd be quite happy with the situation if she were looking on now?
Well, I'm sorry to be a sort of party pooper, but I always refuse to do the would she question, because I think my only selling point is knowing what she did do.
Okay.
And, you know, when there's a question of what she would do, your guess is as good as mine. And
well, it's probably not, to be fair.
No, but people always project what they sort of want by saying Winston Churchill would be turning in his grave if, type of thing. And, you know, they just mean this is their view.
Yeah.
what is true is that the trajectory of her opinions changed. So after she left office, she did explicitly, though not publicly, become pro-leaving. And she would say that to quite a lot of people, including me. But her advisor said, don't say it publicly because it's going to cause so much division in the Tory party. And, you know, you're an old lady sort of thing.
Indeed she was. And there's a whole 100-plus pages in the book on those final years where there's a human side that is obviously important. But, of course, she's still intensely political, and coming back to the question of how hard she remained for someone who'd grown up in the way that I did, very struck by this business of her sending a bottle of scotch to General Pinochet when he's on the run for running a regime of torture. But because he was on the right side, it does suggest a morality where loyalty, in this case to Britain over the Falklands, trumps anything else.
It certainly trumps a lot in her mind, it wasn't actually the issue of torture. If he committed torture, she would not have condoned that. The point here
No, I didn't mean to say she would.
It's the point here is her idea of a legal order. There are two very big points in her mind always. First, loyalty, the one you've noticed is completely true because of the secret importance of Chile in winning the Falklands War. But secondly, her idea of a legal order. What happened with Pinochet is that he was arrested under the warrant, if that's the right word, of a judge in Spain, but executed in Britain.
Mm.
And it seemed to her absolutely unjust when he was the subject of an amnesty in his own country, which his own country had carefully constructed to make sure there was peace in Chile, that this could then be broken open by international, as she saw it, politically motivated legal intervention. That was her big beef. Mm. And so she thought, if anybody wants to try this, gentleman, it should be Chile, and it shouldn't be Britain abetting politically motivated attempts to arrest him. And of course, also, she was in the sort of club of ex-leaders who never liked the idea that they might be have a handcuff shoved on them somewhere in the world.
And then going back to the foreign policy point, this person who's quite narrow and rigid in some ways about the Germans and about maybe this insistence on order above all else, is then creative when it comes to Gorbachev, spotting early that this is, in the famous phrase, before he's even leader, isn't it, that, you know, this is a man I could do business with.
Yes.
How did she see that potential when others didn't, and how important was it for the world?
It was important. Mrs. Thatcher wasn't actually rigid. She was certainly fierce, but she wasn't rigid. She always resisted strategy. People, particularly who worked in business, you would say, come on, Margaret, you've got to have a strategy. And she said, no, politics isn't like that. We'll just, she used to phrase, we'll get stuck on graph paper. What she had, she had long aims, big aims and big beliefs, but not strategy as a business would see it. She hated Soviet communism, and she particularly hated it not so much for geopolitical reasons, but because of the oppression of the peoples of the Soviet bloc. So she was new, and unlike any previous British Prime Minister, except perhaps Churchill, she didn't see it in terms of just of interstate relations. She saw it in terms of what's it like being a Pole under these bastards or whatever. And so she was terrifically popular in those countries for that reason. And having achieved successfully the new generation of cruise and Pershing missiles, and therefore shown the Russians that we could outgun them literally, really, and also that we had more money to do it.
Mm.
She wanted to take advantage of that, to look for change. And she found it in Gorbachev. She was well advised. But he wasn't the leader, just as interesting to point out. When she had that Chequers meeting December 1984, he wasn't even the Soviet leader at that time. So it was pretty smart.
Mm.
She thought now there is a basis, there's a good faith basis for conversation. And she could see that we were winning the Cold War. So maybe in the Soviet system is someone who's going to change it. It's the same view she took about F.W. de Klerk in South Africa. You know, she'd got nowhere with P.W. Botha. But F.W. de Klerk, she realized, did want to bring about the end of apartheid. So don't exclude them, engage. Mm. And Nelson Mandela, when still in prison, was very, very... ANC were pretty anti-Mrs. Thatcher, of course. But he was very impressed specifically by her Gorbachev point, because he applied it to South Africa. He thought, well, wow, if that can be done by her, you know, we need a Gorbachev in South Africa. And interesting, I think he not only meant de Klerk, as it appeared, but in a way he meant himself, because he meant, I can reach across in a way that people won't think I could, and therefore the whole situation changes. And he took specifically the Thatcher example in that respect. And her particular importance, you asked how important it was. Obviously, she wasn't the most important person, because Ronald Reagan was, but she was very persuasive to Reagan on the subject, because she met Gorbachev first. The Americans needed a lot of persuading. She flew extraordinarily weak when she saw Gorbachev in Chequers on a Sunday. She flies to China to sign the Anglo-Hong Kong agreement. She flies to Hong Kong to sell it. This is literally in a week. And then she flies to Washington, D.C. to persuade Reagan about Gorbachev. So it's a pretty sort of dramatic week in the history of world affairs. And she's doing it all the time. It did matter a lot.
A final question. You've dedicated 20 years of your life to doing this book. I know there was a bit before Downing Street and a bit after, but that kind of means you spent probably as much on the Downing Street years, more years writing the Downing Street years than she did living.
Yes, more or less, yeah.
So you kind of got to know, and you knew her, of course, in person as well. She's sort of quite, despite the flexibility there you talk about, quite a, seems from the outside, a haughty, firm, kind of not particularly humorous kind of subject to deal with. I mean, did you ever like wish you were dealing with someone who was a bit more fun?
No, she was fun. She wasn't humorous. She had a very female sensibility, so she didn't like jokes in the way that men make jokes. You know, there's an Englishman, an Irishman, a Scotsman, that sort of joke. She couldn't understand them at all, particularly rude jokes, of course, no idea what. but she was fun because she was so animated and electric. So she would, and also she was sort of flirtatious. I mean, she was, of course, a very proper lady, but she loved men and she wanted to sort of engage. So everything was sort of fiery and exciting. And also she camped up herself. She knew she had this act, so she did it.
Right.
And she would, I don't know, sort of, as it were, sort of almost camply sort of knock you with her handbag, that sort of. Haughty was not the right word. Fierce, yes. Mm. Arrogant in a way, but not haughty, because she had no belief in hierarchy. In fact, she had a reverse belief in hierarchy. So she was horrible to her senior colleagues and incredibly nice to secretaries, porters, drivers. They all loved her. and she would absolutely, without pomposity, she'd, you know, take her shoes off in their presence or whatever, and she'd sometimes even cook them simple meals in the flat and, you know, get worried because they had a cold or that their children were ill or something like that, in a very womanly way, whereas she'd been, you know, utter bastard to Geoffrey Howe. And I think, obviously, it wasn't nice of her to be an utter bastard to Geoffrey Howe, but I think she had it the right way round. Do you see what
I mean? Great. Okay. Charles Moore, thank you very much indeed.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
That's all for this week. Thank you very much for listening. Charles Moore's authorised biography of Margaret Thatcher, that third volume, Herself Alone, it's called, is now out in bookstores. Rebecca Liu is our producer. If you've enjoyed this Prospect podcast, then please do leave us a rating and review, which really does help. We'll see you again next time, and goodbye.